National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Leo XIV passed another week as the Holy Father. We had the installation mass for the start of his pontificate, as well as his first general audience. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Frank Rocha, Vatican editor for EWTN News, and Edward Penton, senior Vatican analyst for the National Catholic Register. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, vice president and editorial director for EWTN News, and your host for Register Radio this week. Shannon Mullen will be joining us once again next week. Well, as we continue here in Rome to focus very heavily on this new pontificate, a lot has been happening. As I just mentioned, Pope Leo XIV was sort of officially installed as Pope, although he had his authority vested in him from the moment he accepted election in the conclave on May 8th. But the events of these last weeks, I think, have done much to reveal some of his thinking and where he might be taking the Church. Let's talk now with Frank Rocha and Edward Penton. Edward, welcome.
Thank you, Matthew.
Frank, it's great to have you, especially in your new role.
Thanks, Matthew. Great to be here with you in Rome.
So let's start with the major event which took place last weekend, which was the official title, I think, is the Mass for the Initiation of the Petrine Ministry of the Bishop of Rome, Leo XIV. It's a mouthful, but it's worth stressing that this is the sort of initiation of his pontificate. And what were your impressions, Edward?
I thought, like all of these inauguration masses, they set the tone for the pontificate, they set the direction, and I think you saw that obviously with this one. I think very much the theme of unity, of peace, of love, of bringing sides together, trying to heal the wounds and divisions was very much central to it. And I think we'd already seen that, but I think it gave a sort of confirmation of that in his homily. So we're going to see more of that bridge building, I think, going forward.
Yeah, we seem to be hearing a lot of in illo uno unum, don't we? Mm. Which is his Episcopal motto, and basically translated from Augustine's commentary on Psalm 127. You know, in we are one in Christ,
yes.
Essentially. Frank, what was your biggest takeaway from the installation mass?
Yeah, I thought, first of all, I agree with Ed that this is very important because he's introducing himself to the Church and to the world. So therefore, what he says is particularly important now. I mean, practically anything that he can say probably was said by Francis and his predecessors at some point or another. The importance is the context. So I think it was very interesting that in his homily for the inauguration mass, he stressed unity. We've been told by many commentators during the transition that unity has become a conservative buzzword because it acknowledges that the Church is not as unified as it ought to be. Now, that's probably always been the case, but I don't think it's overreading. He stressed unity, and I think that's an acknowledgement that the Church is divided, to be blunt. And I also think it was interesting that he said that the Pope is not supposed to be an autocrat. He used that word, and we also know that that's a word that some cardinals and bishops have used some, in some cases under their breath, about Pope Francis, that he was a very willful, monarchical, commanding presence. Some people thought he overreached sometimes, even though he had the authority, that he should have been more collegial. And Pope Leo was stressing that the Pope shouldn't be that way, and that he doesn't want to be that way. That wasn't a direct criticism of Francis, but it does suggest that he thought it needed to be said.
Yeah, he seems mindful, Ed, of the opinions and concerns of the College of Cardinals. We've talked with a number of cardinals. Each of us, I know, we've talked to different cardinals who have said rather bluntly that this was raised in the General Congregations and was raised again to Pope Leo after his election.
Yes, exactly. And it shows that he's very aware of the problems that did develop under Francis' pontificate, and he's going to try to tackle those. I think that was quite clear. We don't know, of course, what he said in the General Congregation, but I think we get an idea that he may have raised some of these issues, and that's why one of the reasons what attracted the cardinals to him, that he seemed to get he had a good grip on what was really a problem in the church at the moment.
Yeah, a couple of cardinals even made reference to the fact that he was taking copious notes throughout the General Congregations.
Right, yes.
So he was very studious, approaching this almost as a canonical issue.
Yes, indeed. And of course, he is a canon lawyer, and that's another string to his bow as well.
Yeah, Frank?
Well, and also in that meeting that he held last Saturday, that the Saturday after he was elected, he held that meeting with the College of Cardinals. And he said, and it's in the text released by the Vatican, that you all of you said in the run-up to the election, to the conclave, that you wanted to meet more. Something that hadn't happened since 2014, a meeting of all the cardinals where they could just stand up and say whatever they were thinking. And he invited them to do that, and they did. And people who were there say that he also took notes on that occasion and listened very carefully and responded in some cases. So that's definitely a gesture and explicit recognition that there needs to be more collegiality, more listening, even to opinions that he might not find pleasant.
Yeah. Ed?
Yeah, it was interesting. I was talking to somebody in the Vatican yesterday who was actually with him on the night of his election, and he said that he has come to him since then. He's a liturgist. He's come to him for advice on the liturgy. And he said if he doesn't know something, he's quite happy to go to an expert who does know and listen. And I think that's what you're getting from him. Obviously, taking notes, he's wanting to be very diligent. But also that element of listening to those who know better than him is something that is a hallmark of who he is. And I think probably augurs well in the future, I think.
Yeah. So talk about the liturgy then itself. It seemed to have been, Frank, it seems to have been very well received. There were some minor complaints, I guess, from some quarters about little technical details about it. But the overall image, Frank, what was the reaction to the liturgy of installation?
Well, I think so far liturgically, he's proved to be very traditional, and that has gratified a lot of traditional people. Traditionalists, devotees of the old mass, are still hopeful, but still not convinced that he will make life a little bit easier for them. But there is a sense that he's restoring a lot of the practices, and that this seems to be received either happily or neutrally. I don't hear much complaint.
Yeah, Ed?
Yes, I think... I asked this person I mentioned just now about what might he do with Traditionis Custodes, and he said that it's likely that he will probably not touch it. He won't necessarily enforce it, but he'll leave it to the bishops to deal with. And I think that's probably what we're going to see with him. He's going to be very much somebody who's going to will try to keep the peace, and so not be very strong on particularly one side or another, but keep things sort of at bay, as it were, possibly sort of muddling through, a bit like the Anglicans do, but maybe not, I don't know. But that sort of hands-off approach, I think, is what we might see.
Right. Well, connected with that in some ways is what I'm coming to call the synodality count. How many times does he use the word synodality or synodal in different speeches? And I know that there was some initial unhappiness among progressives that he didn't seem to be focusing on it or emphasizing it. So let's start with you, Ed, in terms of his, not just his use of synodality, but how is he weaving the concept, the idea, into what he's talking about?
Yes, it's subtly different. I think he's not using the same sort of terminology as Francis did, in exactly the same way. And I think some are analyzing this and saying that it's showing that he's having a different perspective on it, and one which could be one that underlines the importance of the hierarchy within synodality, which is something that was criticized under Francis, his approach was undermining the hierarchy and the ordained clergy as well. Mm-hmm. And so this could be a way to readdress that. But we've only heard words so far. We haven't seen no action, so we don't really know what his approach is.
Yeah, Frank?
Yeah, I think that's right. We don't know yet. He hasn't used it very often. He did use it in a very prominent moment, which is the moment he was introduced to the world. He did invoke synodality on that occasion. He mentioned it with the cardinals a few days later, he mentioned it to an ecumenical group, to an interfaith, ecumenical and interfaith group, which is probably the least sensitive area to talk about that sort of thing, because it doesn't necessarily impinge on the authority of bishops or doctrine. doctrine in the church or anything. It's about sort of communicating and walking together with our, you know, separated brethren in the Christianity and other faiths. I think, you know, someone who knows him pretty well said to me and said he plays his cards very close to his chest. So I think that means we don't know. Synodality is such a vague term. It could just mean having synods, which is something that's not controversial. Or it could mean, who knows, it could mean what Francis seemed to be meaning toward the end. I think we have to see. There was a good report, I don't know if we're allowed to plug other publications, but our former colleagues who now run The Pillar had an interesting report from Peru with some of his former priests, and they all said that he was very, very attentive, very, very strict on liturgy, very strict on liturgy and on doctrine. Now, that may be projecting what they want to believe, but it sounds concrete, and so that we could be, we could see that revealed and unfolded in the coming coming weeks and months.
Yeah, Ed, on that point, and Frank, I want to come back to you because of your reporting on that very topic, his intervention in the 2012 synod. But Ed, on that point of he seems to have a track record of being consistent and clear in church teaching, and even in some of his comments since his election, he doesn't leave a lot of loose ends in his presentations, does he?
No, that's right, Matthew. And I think it's partly to do with his Augustinian training, formation, of course. I mean, it's much clearer. It's a clear theology,
right.
and way of thinking. So I think that's part of it. But there is this speech, which I don't know if you're going to mention about in 2023 that he gave, where Peter is reported on, where he underlines his support for the seamless garment approach. Of equating different moral problems to as one.
Well, what was even striking in that, though, is that at the very end, he goes back and talks about, so that there's no possible misunderstanding, he's not saying, and he makes the point, that there isn't somehow this equivalence among all of it. We'd still have to apply very clear teaching on the priorities that exist within that, the hierarchy.
Yes, and I think that's interesting because it shows that although he appears on the surface to have very much similar views to, say, Pope Francis, when you look deeper, you can pass the words and find that he actually there's a subtle difference in everything he says, which usually underlines the more traditional teaching of the church.
Right, yeah. And so Frank, I mean, in terms of that, we have this example in 2023, but you unearthed. Unearthed is, I know, the phrase that they use, but you had it posted years and years ago. It was there for anyone to read of his intervention in the 2012 synod, right?
Well, we buried the seed and it came to it flowered now, so we earthed it rather. In 2012, when I was in a Catholic news service, he gave then Father Prevost gave an intervention at the synod on the new evangelization, which is the last synod.
And he was ahead of the Augustinians at that point.
That's right. He was the prior general of the Order of St. Augustine, and he gave an intervention at the last synod in the pontificate of Benedict XVI. It was really only a few months before. It was only a few months before Benedict resigned. And it was a very, what we would now call a culture war speech, or what we would have called it then, I think, about, you know, the mass media promoting anti-Christian lifestyle choices, including abortion, euthanasia, same-sex marriage, and adoption by same-sex couples. So very strong. And then, so we interviewed him. We also, he read that on video, and that's the source of most of the references to his pre-papal views on these matters. But we also interviewed him at length, and that interview had not been posted. So that's relatively new, about a lot of things about communication and about St. Augustine and how to evangelize an individualistic society. More subtle, less obviously controversial, but I think also rich. But as we know, as I think we've even said on this show, he was asked about that some years later, and he said that the doctrine hasn't changed, but that Pope Francis has laid a new stress on making everybody welcome, making everybody welcome. But again, that what does that mean? I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean, he said doctrine hasn't changed. And I thought it was interesting, by the way, and I don't, to jumping ahead, perhaps prematurely to the weekly audience, the first weekly audience he gave this week. I thought it was interesting when he talked about the parable of the sower of the seed. Uh-huh. He did make a point that, it's in the parable pretty clearly, that not all the terrain is equally receptive to the seed. So everybody gets the seed, but some people
awfully dry patches of land.
Some soil is more receptive. And so that, I think, sort of solves the problem about, well, everybody's included, but not everybody responds. So that allows for people who object that saying that everybody's welcome doesn't mean that everybody's equally in good standing, so to speak. He didn't put it that way, but one could read it that way, I thought.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break and be right back in our conversation with Edward Penton and Frank Rucca. You're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Please don't go anywhere.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, your host of Register Radio. Continuing my conversation with Frank Rucca and Edward Penton, two seasoned veterans of Catholic journalism who have long followed the events here in the Vatican. And we're continuing our chat about Pope Leo XIV and the early days of his pontificate. And when we left, Ed, we were talking a little bit about Pope Leo's style. Mm-hmm. And one thing that seems to be worth noting is that, let's put it this way, where Pope Francis would often customarily, shall we say, cite only his own documents, and that was his style. Mm-hmm. Pope Leo seems to be much more diverse in his choices for sourcing and footnotes and references, isn't he?
Yes, he is. And obviously, being Augustinian, he's happy to quote the Church Fathers, and that's been an interesting, not just Augustine, but of course others as well.
Yeah, obscure names like Ephrem the Syrian,
indeed.
Simeon the New Theologian.
Indeed, yes, and brings them in a very relevant way, in a clever way, and of course Leo XIII as well. It reminds me, of course, of Benedict and the way he, with his encyclopedic mind, could just pull out quotes from here, there, and everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see that again. It really adds a lot of color and depth to his speeches.
And he cites, it seems to me, a lot of Benedict.
Yes, he does, yes. He's not afraid to quote his predecessors in any way.
Yeah. Right, so as a rhetorical device, so to speak, including these beautiful reflections of his predecessors, everyone from, as you say, Leo XIII to John Paul II to Paul VI, he does also seem to focus very heavily on the Second Vatican Council.
Yes, he does. I don't think in any particularly unusual way. Mm-hmm. I think he just tries to bring in the council in an orthodox way. I don't think he's anything. There's nothing about the spirit of the council or anything like that.
Right.
It's very much, although I think he did mention that once, but I think it's more to do with obviously the true meaning of the council, and perhaps trying to get back to the true interpretation of it rather than the abuse of it that's happened since.
Right. Yeah. And Frank, from the standpoint of covering a pontificate like this, how significant is that in terms of shaping reporting on a pontificate in these early days?
Well, it's a subtle point, but I think an important one that you underlined from the beginning about his references to the council. And I think from at the crudely political level, which doesn't necessarily preclude, it doesn't conflict with a higher, more theological level. I think it's if to some, any extent he's going to be seen as more conservative than his immediate predecessor, which I think is already the case. People have already decided, okay, he's a moderate, and we'll see if that classification shifts again. But then, in a sense, he's covering himself by invoking the council, because so that no one can say, well, okay, this is a step backwards. You know, he's saying, no, we're applying the council. I mean, I think he's sincere, but I think it's also maybe important to emphasize that. Whereas one of Francis's, I think it was Father Spadaro, who's a close advisor to Pope Francis, said early in the pontificate that Francis takes Vatican II for granted. Mm-hmm. I think Leo is not doing that, and he's going, and so, and it may be, as Ed says too, or I think he was suggesting that it's part of the Benedict project at some level of saying, let's get the council right.
Yeah, but if that's the case, then we're verging now into the question of interpretations and implementation, aren't we?
Yes. And this is, I think, something that blew up really under Francis, because you could see a lot of debate, a lot of discussion, a lot of unease about, is this really the true interpretation of the council? And do we need to have some sort of correction of these interpretations? So maybe he's setting the path towards that. It's hard to say, but certainly that's something that's been called for, and something I think many people feel is needed, is some kind of clarification about what the council really taught, and to correct some of those errors where things have sort of been taken out of context, mm-hmm. or and abused. So yeah. I think
well, so far right. We've had a lot of discussion that's been very welcome, of unity, of communion. He tied synodality to collegiality when he was talking to the College of Cardinals, mm-hmm. trying to build those bridges. That's another image. You, at the very start of our conversation today, you used that phrase of building bridges. At a certain point, though, he's going to have to start making some decisions of drawing lines. I'm thinking in particular of Germany.
Exactly, yes. The rubber's going to have to hit the road pretty soon, and it's going to be with Germany and the appointments he's going to have to make, especially, first of all, with the Dicastery for Bishops, where he was, that's got to be made soon. So it'll be interesting to see who he chooses for that. But yes, the bishops in Germany, there's certain concerns, I think, over there about things that he's said. But
you mean the Germans are unhappy?
They're unhappy, yes, exactly. Yes. So it'll be interesting, obviously, to see what he does there. And that's probably going to have to be decisions taken soon as well on that.
Well, and that raises the question, too. As a holder of a doctorate in canon law with long experience in the application of law, are there, Ed, going to be areas that he's going to have to try to clean up, so to speak, canonically, because of the, 75-plus motu proprio that were issued by Pope Francis that in many ways are still unclear in how exactly they're supposed to be handled?
Yes, I think this is definitely going to be a priority of his, and one of the reasons why he was probably elected as well was because he's a canonist, and this was a concern, a big concern during Pope Francis' time, as you say. Cardinal Pell had a great concern about this, that the Vatican had become lawless under Francis. So I think, this is going to be a significant factor. I have heard, in fact, that this is a priority of his, how it's going to play out.
To provide clarity.
To deal with the legal problems that have developed under Francis. I think that's going to be a priority.
Some of which he dealt with, in all likelihood, in some capacity as the bishop in Peru, and then certainly as the prefect here for the Dicastery of Bishops.
Right, yes. And he does have a good track record of dealing with these issues, and in administration, of course, running the Augustinians, and he has a very good a good reputation for dealing with these issues and sorting them out. So it augurs well.
One of my favorite observations of somebody who worked with him was that in all the years that they worked together, he never saw him lose his temper.
Right, yes. He does seem that very calm,
very
measured
calm
man.
Serene is the word that we're hearing.
Yes.
Real quick, in the brief time we have left, I want to hear from each of you. What are you working on, and what are you anticipating in the next few weeks?
Right. Well, I just finished an article, which is going to be published soon, on his appointment to the John Paul II Institute, which is a very interesting new appointment of his, one of his first appointments to replace Archbishop Vincenzo Paglia with the Vicar of Rome. That's an interesting appointment. because it was went to the heart of very much of Pope Francis's approach to moral theology, and it seems to be a rolling back to how to closer to being what John Paul wanted. So we'll see about that.
Yeah, now we have to wait for the Pontifical Academy for Life and how that all plays out, right?
Right, that's the other one that Archbishop Pallia had, so yeah, we'll see about that.
Okay,
yeah.
Ed, thanks.
Right, I guess that's right. The other shoe that has to drop is what Pallia has been replaced with, because of course Pallia was 80, he just turned 80, so it was notable that he moved so quickly.
Yes.
That he moved so quickly. I just keep thinking, as I did with Francis, that in both cases the Pope knows how these things will be taken, the kind of impact they will have, especially at the beginning of a pontificate. So you have to factor that in. You have to say he knows that doing this first will be taken as a sign. Therefore, it must be a sign at some level. He's not just being casual about it. As for future themes, well, one thing is that, you know, we're hearing reports that in mid-June the Vatican will be hosting peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So I think that will be something, a big story that our writers will be and our TV people will be covering. But also, if the Vatican is taking a different approach under Leo than it did under Francis, Leo seems to be clearly more pro-Ukraine. There's lots of evidence for that. His reaching out to Zelensky and so forth. So that will be a big story.
All right. Well, thank you both. And I know all of us are looking forward to your reporting on Pope Leo, on what's happening here in Rome. So thank you for your work and God bless you.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for joining me this week on Register Radio. Until next time, please take care. And remember, you can go to ncregister.com for a lot more news and commentary. Thank you so much again for listening. Until next week, take care.